So, yeah, once again, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Katja Volkova-Volkmar from Rush, Basel. And she's going to tell us about how deep learning is used in biomedicine. Take it away.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a big pleasure to present to you today. I did a similar lecture about a year ago, but back then it was still in person and it was quite a bit more extensive. It was 3 hours of lectures and 3 hours of practice. So I had to condense the material a lot and I also updated it. But just a little bit about me. I was born in Russia many years ago. I started in actually linguistics and English studies after school. Got slightly bored after a couple of years and moved to Tübingen, Germany. Studied computational linguistics. And while I was doing computational linguistics studies, I got really interested in neuroscience. So my PhD was in cognitive neuroscience in Max Planck for biological cybernetics. After I finished my PhD, I moved to UK and worked there as a data scientist for a few years in two very nice companies. I really learned a lot there. But towards 2018, I started missing the continental life again, and I was looking for opportunities in mainland Europe. And I was again very, very fortunate to get the role of senior data scientist at Roche in pharma research and early development informatics department. So all of my work is currently with the digital biomarkers group, and particularly I focus on Parkinson's disease. So there I'm so-called data analysis SIEM lead, and the SIEM is Parkinson. And I do a lot of analysis of human behavior when they perform so-called active tests on the smartphones that we provide them that accompany clinical trials. But enough about me. So what's the plan for this lecture? We only have 1 hour, unfortunately. I wish we had a whole semester. I could tell you much more. So I want to go through four major points. What is deep learning at all? What is it? And what is it good for? We will learn some basics so that we can then further go in a bit more depth into two flavors of deep learning, convolutional neural networks and graph convolutional networks. And there's many more flavors, but yeah, we clearly don't have the time for all that. One note, there's going to be lots of extra links on almost on every slide. Some of them are going to be just sources for images that I stole from very nice resources. Some of them are going to be links to true resources where you can go and learn more in detail. And they're all spelled verbatim because I don't want you to worry, like, oh, if I click on this link, where is it going to take me? I've checked them all because some of them were already there a year ago. I've checked them all this week. They're all live and some were even updated. So I really hope you will find this material helpful. Right, before we go into deep learning itself, me as a machine learning practitioner, I want to emphasize some practical advice. First of all, you'll probably, many of you heard that all models are wrong, but some models are useful. So when we apply machine learning or just even statistical models, we're trying to explain the data we observe in the world and we're trying to find patterns that are useful. Any model will always have some bits and pieces of our data that's not explained, but we hope that it's just noise and not important. So we care about models that are useful and how do we build them. So another very frequent phrase that's heard from all machine learning practitioners is garbage in, garbage out, meaning that, well, we want our model to represent, to explain and predict a certain phenomenon. If the data we're training the model on is not representative of that phenomenon, the model will be useless as such. So be really, really careful. This is a very unforgiving rule, especially in deep learning. Then again, when we talk about deep learning in particular, many people treat it as some kind of magical tool, partially because it's really hard to interpret. But the usual machine learning pitfalls like overfitting and bias apply to deep learning as well. It's not a silver bullet. So you have to be very watchful there as well. And when, since I mentioned that deep learning is harder to interpret, this is kind of the part of the so-called there's no free lunch. So if you build a very simple, very easy to interpret model, for example, you have three variables and you're predicting some outcome and you can see, like you can, it's very, very clear, right? You have your coefficients, you have your confidence intervals. You can say, okay, this feature is doing this, this feature is doing that. Lovely. With deep learning, you have thousands, maybe even millions of parameters. It's impossible to interpret. Your model can be much more powerful for very complex data, but yeah, you lose this interpretability. And there are tools that help us to interpret models in deep learning as well. And I think it's also everybody's responsibility and duty to apply them, because I think it's very important to understand what the model does. Right. Another advice I would like to give you is that don't be just a number cruncher. Really understand the problem you're trying to solve and the data. In the early days of data science, I often heard opinions like, oh, well, it doesn't matter that you don't know genetics, which I don't, I'm not a biologist. You will just do your number crunching and everything will work out. This is really dangerous, I think. So at least if you're not the expert in the field where the data is coming from and the problem and trying to solve, make sure that you have a very strong connection to somebody, to an expert. And then you can always show them some intermediate results so that they can help you understand the problem better. And then there's also another aspect of machine learning. Often at times, especially in research and also in industry, models are built to interpret the data and not necessarily to predict. And that's fine. But if you want your model to live on some server or in some app, that's called machine models in production, and it goes into the area of ML ops operationalization, and that calls for model maintenance, which means that even if you're very certain that your model is really great and performs well, please continue testing it over time on new data. There can be shifts in what the true data for this true phenomenon looks like. And make sure to analyze and fix the errors. Otherwise, over time, your model will become useless. And I have a very, very forceful advice here. Please watch this course at least twice. It's from Andrew Ng from Coursera. It's really, really great. And it is tailored towards deep learning, but the things you can learn, the things you can learn there are applicable to other machine learning flavors as well. Okay, this was a long slide. I think it's really, really important. I didn't want to skip over it. Now we can finally start into our journey with deep learning. So what is deep learning? It's a set of methods that really took off in like the last 10 years. It's a subset of other machine learning algorithms and tools. Machine learning is a bit older. It took off thanks to three factors. I mean, actually the methods themselves, at least their philosophy, was there since quite a longer period of time. But there was not enough compute power to make them scalable, and there was not enough data itself to train these models on. So really with the dawn of big data and faster computers, deep learning finally took off. Machine learning itself is part is a subset of artificial intelligence. So not all artificial intelligence needs machine learning to perform, but many more such algorithms do. And many of them now, the newest ones, they often rely on deep learning. And I think a big distinction between so-called classic or like sometimes called old school machine learning and deep learning is the fact that in typical machine, like in the old school machine learning project, you as a machine learning practitioner, you would do feature extraction manually on your own. Like either you already receive a data set and you start looking at it and do plotting and exploratory data analysis, and you think, well, maybe I'll add a few more features here. If you encode this data this way, then I'll extract extra things, merge new data sets together, and then you perform your classification. deep learning does feature extraction for you, because the typical inputs it works on, like images or free or like some speech recordings or text, there it's almost impossible to come up with a very useful set of features for all cases. So this is also a very, I think, important distinction between classical machine learning and deep learning. So when we talk about people who contributed to the rise of deep learning, there's of course many more than just these three very smart gentlemen, but I wanted to highlight their personalities in particular, because a couple of years ago they actually got a Turing Award specific for contribution into to deep learning and deep neural networks. They're still very active in the field, and for example, I really like that they even challenge their own old ideas, so they're still contributing, and I really advise you to learn more about them if you have the time. Medicine is very close to my skin. I fell in love with digital health after I finished my PhD, and I think I'm really, really fortunate to work in this field now, which is why, of course, when I want to update myself on what deep learning is good for, I first and foremost look how it can be used in medicine. And the uses are plentiful, so it can help in diagnosis. For example, you have an image of some cells, and you want to figure out, like a biopsy, and you want to figure out whether it's cancerous or not, right? Medical imaging doesn't have to be just about diagnosis. You can also, maybe you already know that, like, somebody with Parkinson, right? They can take brain scans over time. And again, deep learning can help to figure out how the disease is developing over time. Deep learning is supporting clinical trials. This is somewhat more challenging, because clinical trials, there you have to be absolutely clear and very, very accountable. And like I mentioned before, deep learning is sometimes hard to interpret. But nevertheless, in some aspects, deep learning definitely already helps. And last but not least, especially in the last couple of years, deep learning was shown as an amazing tool for drug discovery, which is a very, very laborious, very expensive process otherwise. So it could be that in deep learning would really be a tool to solve some huge bottlenecks in this area. So these were the areas. Well, who are the companies that are very active in deep learning medicines in particular? So some of my favorites, and are actually local on the island, are Babylon Health. They are helping to scale general health in UK, and they have the, I'm not sure whether that model is kind of falls into the class of deep learning, but they have a very clever Bayesian network that has passed a doctor's exam, GP exam. So if you give it symptoms, and it keeps asking interactively, like, oh, do you have this symptoms? And what about this symptoms? It can diagnose your disease pretty reliably. Then Benevolent AI has shown some breakthrough in drug discovery recently. DeepMind has its own department in health, where they also try to optimize certain aspects of healthcare. And of course, there's big pharma companies like Roche, where I work, Novartis, AstraZeneca has been expanding their staff in terms of machine learning skill set. And last but not least, there are the usual tech giants like Google, Apple, Amazon, IBM, and Philips. They all have very strong departments in health and healthcare. Right, so deep learning has been going out and doing great things. Are there any horizons where it still has to reach? So for me, the most interesting topics are the following, where I hope that the next breakthroughs will take place. Causal inference and reasoning. So even though deep learning looks like it's super wise and it can just tell you whether there is a cat on the picture or not, and many, yeah, and of course, many other useful things, it still it's still just patterns. It's still correlation, essentially. And what is still often missing is this causal link. And I really recommend you to read this book, The Book of Why. It's very non-technical. It's very engaging. I think I read it twice already because, it's just really interesting to think about. It's a very different way of thinking about data. Then we still have lots of problems in algorithmic bias and bias in data. And again, deep learning being somewhat more obscure, it's harder to catch this bias, but it's very important to check for it. Then this, like I said, we still need to increase transparency and interpretability in deep learning, and that in particular would help in clinical adoption in my case, in my opinion. For example, if you want to submit a new algorithm for diagnosis to FDA, it has to be very, very clear. So I doubt that even something like a random forest would be very welcome there, unless it's very clearly explained. Imagine how much chance deep learning model would have. And a new point added recently is meta learning. And that's a hot topic right now as well, because the resulting models are highly, highly specialist. I will show you an example later, an interactive example, you'll see what it means. So currently the search is for a more general learning approach. So an algorithm that was trained on one thing and then can do a completely different one or learn it much, much faster. Right. So this was just a very quick tour the force. Where can you learn more? There's online courses. I've done plenty of them during my PhD and after, and still do them if I have the time. There's tons of podcasts. There's of course many, many books. I highlighted just two of like a couple of dozen. There's so many YouTube channels. Some of them are just absolutely brilliant. I wouldn't recommend, like the only YouTube channels I wouldn't recommend is where the instructor tells you, oh, deep learning is so easy. You just type these two lines of code and you're done. Please don't follow that advice. Please try to understand in depth what is actually going on. So there's lots of blogs, of course, and a whole class of them is from Medium. I particularly really like towards data science. And of course, there's always papers. I have a more detailed list on my blog. So if you want to check it out, you're more than welcome. Right, so let's imagine that after this talk, you're super inspired and you want to learn more about deep learning, and maybe you already have a problem that you would like to solve and you have data for it. Brilliant. So how do you do it? Do you go and program all the code from scratch on your own? You don't have to do that. There are at least four, and the number is always growing, platforms that can help you build your models. They all have slightly different flavors, different advantages and disadvantages. Within my team, we tend to use PyTorch because it's very Python friendly. But my first models I've built on TensorFlow and Keras. I mean, Keras is like a very nice friendly wrapper for TensorFlow essentially. So, all right, we're done with the main introduction. Let's look a bit closer into what kind of flavors exist in deep learning. So we will start with the what I call grandpa perceptron. That's the main kind of the simplest building block of deep learning. And we will next go into multi-layer perceptron. And as you can see here, there's kind of five main families. So there's convolutional neural nets. They work on images mostly. There's graph neural nets that work on graph, and they kind of have a baby together with graph convolution nets. We will talk about them in more detail because it's kind of an easy step from convolutional neural nets to graph convolutional nets. But if you want to work with text or speech, then you might be better off with the recurrent neural nets and the long short-term memory nets that are kind of an extension of RNNs. Again, some people have done very good research or have achieved very good results on, for example, speech recognition with CNNs actually. But yeah, it's a way to do it. I'm not to judge them. Then a whole different beast is deep reinforcement, and which I think will it's a very promising field. And there is autoencoders and guns. We will not have time to go into them. So these are generative adversarial networks. So yeah, these ones are out of scope today. We just, all these, we will not have the time. So there's not going to be lots of technical detail today, again, due to the lack of time, but I still want you to understand in quite a bit of detail what perceptron does. Perceptron is just a linear model, nothing else. It's just a, not exactly nothing else, but essentially it's a linear model. So you have, so can you see my cursor? Can you see my mouse? Is there like a, I haven't used Zoom much before.
Yes,
you can see. Okay, great. So yeah, so here you have the inputs, right? Your features. So perceptron or multi-layer perceptrons, they can work on tabular data. In fact, some of my colleagues use it oftentimes as a benchmark. You get a new tabular data set, you throw it onto the multi-layer perceptron, you get your outcome, and then on your better models, you try to improve. You try to fight overfitting, or you try to just get better accuracy overall. So here you have your inputs, and on these inputs, you also apply certain weights. And then you just sum them up. That's all you do, and you add your bias, which is the intercept. So in statistics, these are coefficients, and this is the intercept. And then as the outcome, so you get this weighted sum, essentially, and you look whether it's above zero or not. And from that, you judge whether you should say like one or zero on as the output. That's all what perceptron is, and it's quite old. You see, it was there even before the 60s. And this is the building block for essentially all deep learning networks. And it can do it can do linear separation. It can build a linear model. So, well, you might be thinking how we have this input, right? This is in our data. How do we find the weights? Because judging, like depending on these weights, you would have a model that is either totally off, right? It's just not accurate at all. Here we have our ground truth as dots, and then we have two classes, and then we have our predictions. And the model says, well, I'm super sure that this point is red, which is not true. Then when we adapt, when we change the weights and the intercept, then we can say, okay, now model thinks that this is the good fit, and here it's actually 50-50. So this is an improvement, but it could do better. So we iterate on, and I will tell you exactly how we iterate. And now we have actually, if we count how many classes are marked blue and how many red, we see that this model is much more accurate, but it's not perfect. A perfect fit is actually a model that kind of maximizes distance from the line where it's 50-50 to your training set. So yeah, exactly. How do we help this line to rotate? How do we help this line to find an optimal fit? So in linear, like in regression, but also in perceptron approach, what you use is gradient descent. And here on the y-axis, we have our so-called cost function, or how accurate our model is. So here it's basically at the bottom, you have no error or like minimum possible error. And the higher up you go, the worse your model is performing. And you do this by basically looking at the distance towards these dots and encoding whether they were categorized correctly or not. So you can, initially the weights are generated randomly. It can be set to zero, but it can be also generated randomly. It doesn't matter because once you have one outcome, or like a couple of dots, you can build your gradient, and the gradient tells you how far off, like kind of the steepness of the slope tells you how far off you are, because what you want to get is to a completely parallel slope. When your gradient is zero, you know that you've gotten there. It's a bit more tricky than that. It's a bit more detailed than that. But the beauty of gradient descent is that you know, you always know where to go, in which direction, and by how much you're off. So you can adapt your steps with time. So you don't have to take tons of tiny, tiny, tiny steps. If you only knew the direction, then you would have to do that. But you also know by how much approximately you need to go. So if you have very few data points and very few parameters, you can afford to do gradient descent as it is. But I will also talk about the trick that allows you to do it faster. But let's first go into a slightly more complex architecture. So we only had one perceptron before. Well, what if we have two or three or 16 or 200? We still have our inputs, and then we still have our weights that we're fitting. And here we have two linear models, and they will have their own weights and their own biases. And then they can encode two different linear models. And by combining these two different models, we can actually apply classification, for example, to nonlinear situations. Like imagine if you actually had this kind of class dependency that blue dots, so we basically have here maybe one feature and another feature, and we know that blue dots are typically at least half or over of our range on the x-axis and more or less half or over on the y-axis. So it's an AND situation. And this allows us to encode for this non-linearity. And of course, yeah, the more layers we have, the more neurons. So this one, this hidden layer is called now neuron. The more detail we can add to this non-linearity on as many dimensions as we want. So this is where the this is the basics of all deep learning approaches, more or less. And a very important trick. And I see the chat messages here. Sorry. Okay, apologies. Let's go back. No, doesn't want to go back. Wait.
Maybe click the back arrow in the bottom.
Yeah. No, it's working now. So another very important aspect of deep learning is backpropagation, and that's basically when you. So you have your architecture. Before we had a very simple architecture with just one hidden layer. Like I said, you can have multiples, and very quickly you get a fairly complex system where you have weights on every edge. And so you take your inputs, you generate your weights, you apply them to these neurons, you activate them or not, depending on the outcome, then they themselves generate weights and so on. And essentially you get them to the output. For example, if you have a binary outcome, you say, okay, with this input from this example, it looks like I have maybe a probability of 0.6 on one class and 0.4 on the other class. But actually we know that the right answer is just 100% on the first class and then zero probability on the other. How do we correct for this? So we then calculate our cost function and we backpropagate it saying, well, yeah, you need to correct these weights in this direction and these weights in this direction. And this is called backpropagation. And when you have like a forward, so it's like the wave from input to output layer is called feed forward pass. And then the correction of these weights, the adjustment of these weights is called backpropagation. And one cycle of those two is called epoch. And usually when you train your deep learning models, you have multiple epochs. For very, very simple scenarios, just a dozen might suffice. But for very complicated data, you might need hundreds. But gradually your model will converge and will adjust the weights so that any input will generate most of the times correct results. So you already see that with even very few layers and very few neurons, we already have so many parameters, these weights, for example, right? It's quite natural that with larger data sets and larger system architectures, the whole training process will slow down. Even with much faster computers that we have today, it's still going to take too long. And the beauty, the great news is that it doesn't have to take this long. You don't have to build to do gradient descent approach for every single input, every single feature. What you can take shortcuts. So some of the shortcuts are called the stochastic gradient descent and dropout, and they work on just two aspects of the neural net. So stochastic gradient descent does gradient descent, but not on all of the inputs, just on a few of them at a time. So it takes batches. It just selects them randomly and does the gradient descent on them. And dropout does kind of the opposite. So it randomly switches off nodes in the hidden layers. And that means that not all of them are activated at the same time. It not only do these tricks help you to train your network faster, but they also make it more robust. Deep learning networks are amazing at overfitting. If you give them a chance, they will just memorize the whole training set by heart and will basically give you perfect results on your training data and be awful and useless on any new data. But the stochastic gradient descent and dropout help you to make these models more generalizable. I once heard a lovely metaphor on a podcast saying that so neural nets are very good at finding maximum optimum the perfect optimums in your feature space, which often look like deep weights, deep wells. Once a neural network finds it, it will not be able to get out of it. And so these stochastic gradient descent and dropout, it's like the model is wearing very big boots, so it cannot fall into these wells. So I think it's a nice metaphor for this. Still, with enough epochs, you can always overfit, and you need to know when to stop. So you can still apply old good regularization that you might know from elastic nets, for example, and L1 and L2. But also, as you train model, you need to watch out for gradual divergence between the train data set and the validation, because you should always have two. You should always split your data into train and validation, and you should also have the holdout, the ultimate test. And as you're training your network, you measure the error on the train, right, to adjust the weights, and you get that error there. And you should also then apply these weights exactly on the validation data set. And as your model trains, the error first goes in synchrony down in both. But once your model starts memorizing your examples, then the error in the train will further decrease, while in validation it will increase. And this is then you know, okay, I need to stop here. So that's also a very important aspect to keep in mind. Right. How are we doing on time? So this was general information about perceptron and MLP. Let's look into more detail into CNNs, because I think they're a very fascinating breakthrough in machine learning, and they really managed to do something that people were not able to do before. Also, for us as humans, it's really easy to, like, we have an amazing visual sensory system. So it's really easy for us to recognize objects. So we look at this and say, okay, 5, 5, cat. For a computer, it's not so obvious. And if we did the machine learning, the old school machine learning approach, we would have to handcraft these feature extraction. And we could come up maybe with some filters and say, well, 5, what does it usually look like? Well, there's always this kind of ear that's going from left to right. And there's like a sharper bit just above it. But then you get another 5, which is all smooth, and then your filter is not working anymore. And then try imagining coming up with all the rules that tell you that this is a cat in a mask, and not a tiger, and not a lion, and not a puppy. So imagine doing that. That's nigh impossible. People have tried, but it usually failed. So the CNNs, being part of the deep learning family, they do feature extraction themselves, and they also solve a very important problem in images, because images can be really, really large. I mean, this is a very pixely image, the 5s here, but often at times, for example, especially in medical imaging, the resolution is really, really high, and you get really large images. So how do you extract information from these images that you can condense it and still keep it useful? So CNNs, they have two big tricks here. They have convolution layers, and they have pooling layers. Convolution is basically when you take a small window of pixels, maybe like 3x3, it can be 11x11, 7x7, you are the architect, and you apply filters to them, and your filter has some pretty fine numbers, and it's often randomly generated, and you just do matrix multiplication, this pixel to this pixel, this pixel to this pixel, this is not a pixel, this is just a number, and you sum them up, and you put them, and you record them basically in your next layer, in your output layer. Pooling does something even more simple. It takes 3x3 pixels, for example, or some other patch, it's usually square patch, and it just takes the maximum value out of those and records that. So here you see we have 6x6, and as the output we got 2x2, because this patch of 3x3 went 1, 2, 3, 4. And there we go, it extracted the maximum number. It doesn't have to be maximum, it can be median, whatever you prefer, but it helps to condense the information. So these filters, they are quite curious. Like I said, they can be randomly generated, you can pre-specify them if you want, and depending how they're built, they can highlight certain features. So they can either detect edges, right, if you have higher values in the middle or lower values in the middle or vertical arrangement, they will detect edges in the image. They can sharpen the image by kind of depressing values on the outside and highlighting values in the middle. You can do blurring, all kinds of things. And what's interesting is that I will show you a typical neural net architecture in a moment, but essentially, by applying very similar filters from layer to layer, you're able to extract more and more complex features. So at first, they will just detect maybe edges in the image, and then they will detect more complex items. And then in the third, fourth, fifth layer, you will see whole objects. So this is really a very interesting property of these filters. And this is what a typical CNN would look like. This is not a very large network. Like I said, you are the architect. You decide on many hyperparameters, how many layers to have, how to arrange them, what should be the size of the filters, how many filters should you have. But the kind of the flow of information remains the same, that you start with your image as the input, and then you do convolution. Usually you start with convolution, and you extract kind of more, you highlight important information using these filters. So usually if you have one input image, maybe it has 3 channels, 3 colors, but you usually apply multiple filters. So you get a stack of these. And then the information from these layers is passed on to the pooling, and you condense the information. And then you do convolution on this condensed information. Why not? And then you condense it a bit further until you come to a, you don't have to condense it to the point that you have one-to-one here in like a pooled map or a convolutional layer. At some point you just say, okay, I'm just taking all of these, what's remaining of this, and I'm turning it into a vector. And this is your last, your dense, so-called dense layer. And this is the last vector of neurons that will have these, they will be activated, and the activation pattern will then be mapped to a certain class. So here we have just 2 classes, pathology, not pathology, but they were also very successful experiments where you could train the network to recognize, I don't know, 100 classes. And yeah, I don't think we have the time for this, but I really, really encourage you to go to this interactive example, because there you can actually see how the neural net works. And it's really great. And you can click and always get more detail, and you can really see how the information is flowing. Right. So what I've pointed out before, that filters and higher layers capture more and more general information. Well, we can use this property in the techniques that's called guided propagation, and it's just one of possibilities to help to interpret your neural net. Because yeah, with so many parameters, it's impossible that you will look at every single weight and say, oh, now I know what it means. Well, now I know what it's doing. No, here you have to find a way to output the results which kind of contributed to network's decision. And with using guided propagation and similar techniques, you can really see, okay, the network said that this picture is a dog, and when it said so, it was taking this information into consideration. It regarded this as important. There is an urban myth about one early machine, like deep learning experiment, where I think the story goes that the researchers were trying to classify tanks, maybe like which country a tank came from. And they, on the training set, the model was very accurate. But later on, it just couldn't, it was complete mess. And once they looked deeper, they realized that the background was contributing more. So like somehow all the tanks were always in snow or on a desert. And that's what the model learned to pay attention to. It turns out to be, it's very likely just an urban myth, but it does happen. There is a real example where X-rays were marked very, very finely by a clinician whether they had pathology or not. It was just a little pen mark somewhere in the corner that nobody else noticed. Yet the model noticed it, and it had perfect performance. I mean, it didn't care what kind of image was on the X-ray, just, mark means it's pathology. And then, of course, when new images started coming in that didn't have that mark, because they were from a different hospital and from a different condition, the model was completely helpless. So it's really important, I think, to pay attention to these things. So we've talked a lot about how you can speed up the training with dropout and stochastic gradient descent. Yet, when you have very little data, for example, or you're really pressed for time and compute power, you can have another shortcut, and that's called transfer learning. So the trick is that whatever your data set is it animals, is it cars, is it X-rays, the first layers are usually learning to detect edges and little properties of the images. And if you think that they are common enough, that they're also common in your problem, in your data set, then you can actually use an already pre-trained model like ImageNet. You can load it using some of the frameworks that I've told you about. You can load it into your system, use the weights from as output weights from a certain layer, for example, the first four. We say, okay, we don't want to train our model. We just cut them and transfer them to our model, and we use them, and then continue the training further on. So that shortens your time considerably, and the results are still very good. To the point that when I mentioned once that I want to train the model from scratch, people are like, why? Why would you do that? They're working just fine on transfer. All right, so that was a very quick introduction into CNN. And we still happily have some time to talk about graph neural nets, because this is a very exciting area. They really took off just a couple of years ago. There's new flavors being born, I don't know, every month. And the applications are really fascinating. But first, let's talk about what a graph is and how are they different from other inputs. So we know already that CNNs and RNNs can work on images or text or speech, but what if we have a graph? Right, so here we have a pretty complex and senseless graph. It was generated randomly. We have five nodes and they're connected. The connections are actually directed. So you can go from 1 to 0, but not back, right? We don't have an arrow that goes back. Not all graphs have to be so-called directed. It could be just a link and you can go both ways. And it can be anything. It could be, for example, that this is a surgeon. Node 1 is a surgeon and node 0 is a patient. This is a symptom and this is a disease or vice versa. Or this is a drug and this is a side effect. Or these are two proteins and they interact. So that you can encode so many things. But how would you do deep learning on them? Graph theory itself is very, very old. And even without deep learning, we can do amazing stuff there. We can count the neighbors. This is the adjacency matrix, so you can see how the nodes are connected. You can do community detection. So one of my past roles, community detection was a very important aspect on Twitter, for example. But yeah, if your graph is really, really complex and you want to do very, very subtle things on it, like maybe you want to assign nodes, some nodes classes, and you have labels for most of them, but not for all. How do you do this with these traditional methods? It's pretty tricky. And for a long time, this was a real problem because graph is not structured, right? If you take it's not an image with its pixels that are a grid. It's not a text where every word is following another word. So how do you do convolution on them, for example? And you don't have to do convolution. Not all graph neural nets are graph convolution nets. It's just one flavor. But yeah, it was a big challenge. And I think what helps here is to think that, well, an image is a grid. And when we do convolution in it, we just take information from these nine pixels, for example, depending what our kernel is, and then we update it, we turn it into one pixel or one value. So it turns out you can do the same on graphs, but instead of having a predefined grid and always needing 9 or any other square number of nodes, you just say, well, I have this node and I have its neighbors. And imagine that, so what you need though is that every neighbor or every node has some features. And if it's a patient, for example, then you have their height, weight, age, blood pressure, temperature, and you need to make sure that every node has these features and also in the same order. And what you do when you want to do graph convolution is the first step is to take information from each of the neighbor from the node in question, extract features from those neighbors, and then, for example, they don't do any kind of mathematical function that suits you, for example, averaging. And then you take the features that on that node and, for example, average that with the average information from the neighbors. So essentially, like, you're sloshing the information about, because you also do it for every node. What would that be good for, though? Like, why would we need to propagate this information? It's called message passing. Well, it's useful in case you have labels on these nodes, but not on the one you're interested in, and you want to classify this node. Is it a patient at risk, right? Is it a fraudulent account? So, of course, what's very important in this case is that your graph, the connections in it actually make sense, right? These connections cannot be random. In an image, it's dictated just by the position of the pixels, and then it makes sense. Imagine you just scramble the pixels in the picture. You yourself will not be able to recognize whether it's a cat or a dog. So there, the position makes sense. Here, it has to make sense as well. But yeah, essentially, this is one of the things you can do with graph convolution. What are other things that GNNs in general are good for? Well, so like I said, for example, node classification maybe can help you in disease diagnosis. Protein interaction or drug protein interaction, that would be called link completion. So you have your nodes in the graph and you want to figure out whether they're connected or not. There is also a very interesting technique called node embedding. where you just want to condense the feature space into maybe just represent clusters in your graph, and that you can do that by using node embedding, or you can classify whole graphs, not just a node in a graph, but whole graphs. And that can help you, for example, with molecule class prediction, is it toxic or not? So it's the diversity of the application. That was just medicine, right? The graphs are useful in social network analysis, of course, like I said, banking fraud detection, all the things, because very large, there's very large diversity of information that you can encode in the graph. So yeah, really fascinating field. And when preparing this lecture, I went through maybe like 40 different resources, and I want to highlight just a few of them here, and they're kind of split into chunks. So these are very nice user-friendly talks and blog posts on graph convolutional networks. Then we have a very interesting talk and very recent talk by Michael Bronstein, and he's in London, and he's very, very active in this area. Then this is number four, is a very good review of methods and applications of graph neural networks. They really go through all the possible flavors and all the possible uses of graphs in deep learning. This is a book that is also very fresh, and it's available on preprint online. And again, if you want to go out and do things and program and train your models on graphs, there are already tools how to do that. So there is a deep graph library that is very stable and works even on top of other tools and DL frameworks. And for example, for life sciences, DeepChem is a very useful collection of tools. It's not exclusively deep learning on graphs, but that area is very, occupies a large chunk of it. So yeah, I hope you've learned some new things today. Those of you who are already deep learning practitioners, hope it was a good recap. I thank you very much for your attention. And I have one last link here, which is about attention networks, which is another very interesting technique in neural nets that allows them to improve their results even further. And yeah, look at it. We even have some time for questions. I would especially welcome maybe some more practical questions or machine learning in industry, all this stuff, because we wouldn't have time to go through the math in depth. But if you go through all the links that I've posted in those in the slides, you will know these topics better than I do, maybe.